Call to order this meeting of the St. Lawrence County Board of Legislators Operations Committee. It is Monday, January 8th, 2018, approximately 5:30 p.m. First, I need a motion to approve the agenda. Mr. Denisha, seconded by Mr. Perkins and Mr. Arquette. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. And then I need a motion for approval of the minutes of the December 11th meeting. Mr. Arquette, seconded by Mr. Burke. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. First item of business tonight is an address on the state of the EMS. The EMS Advisory Board Secretary, Treasurer, and North Country Regional EMS Program Director Ann Smith is going to present that. And for the record, as she comes up, I just want to say Mr. Fay is excused tonight. Mr. Leader will have to leave at 7 p.m. And Mr. Paquin, I guess, is tied up for a little bit in some weather coming in from Messina.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present here tonight on behalf of Emergency Medical Services in St. Lawrence County. As the agenda stated, I am the North Country EMS Program Agency Director. We're contracted under Fort Drum Regional Health Planning Organization to provide healthcare deliverables for the New York State Bureau of EMS. I am also a provider here in the county. I maintain credentials as an EMT, and I volunteer my services as for local fire department, as well as run with a not-for-profit agency as a medic. With me tonight, I have the chair of the St. Lawrence County EMS Advisory Board, Carol Munch, as well as the vice president of the advisory board, Mark Devers, so they will be available to assist with any questions that you may have. So one of the reasons that I'm here tonight is to brief you on a critical issue of EMS that is not unique to this county. It's happening across the nation, but being that St. Lawrence County is so rural, the effects of it can be much worse. I'm hoping to get your assistance and involvement in addressing this issue. So I guess my first question to all of you is, what is your expectation when you call 911? If you're having a heart attack, or let's say you're having chest pain, you may not know you're having a heart attack. What's your expectation? That you're going to receive an ambulance, right? In a timely manner. Unfortunately, that is not the case, and it is becoming, there's longer and longer response times that are happening for a variety of reasons. And you know, if you could get that ambulance to your door, they can do everything in most cases that an emergency can do in the first crucial minutes of a medical emergency. So if you're having a heart attack, they can bring you the medicine that can help you and get that to you quicker than, you know, even if you were to drive yourself to the ER. With that said, time is heart muscle, time is brain tissue, and time can also be the determining factor whether you live or die after a multi-system trauma. So in many cases, as I said, it's taking greater than 30 minutes, sometimes 40 minutes plus, to get an ambulance to members within our communities. So to just kind of give you a little bit of history of how EMS evolved and what some of the challenges are behind this is, modern EMS began in the 1960s. During that time, in much of the country, an ambulance ride was just that. It was a ride to the hospital. Most of the time, this ride was done by the local funeral director, and depending on your clinical situation, they looked at you and said, are you dead or are you alive? If you're dead, you go to the morgue, and if you're alive, they would give you a ride to the hospital without even, you know, providing any medical care, if any, maybe some very basic first aid. Today, that's changed. Education, regulation, and technology now allows ambulances to provide a high level of care and carry sophisticated equipment. And again, as I said, these advanced level ambulances can give you that life-saving treatment in the field, that the same thing that they can do in a hospital emergency room. It's no longer just a ride to the hospital. So while the capabilities have evolved in this county, the delivery system has not. Not here in St. Lawrence County or across the nation in many cases. So St. Lawrence County relies mostly on a volunteer EMS system. However, due to many factors, volunteerism is declining. Those factors include, but are not limited to, the need for increased education for the EMTs, decreased access of education. We have a limited number of EMS instructors in the county, and of entities that can even offer the instruction to certify these EMTs. Social and economic factors are also play a role. The hours to volunteer and the commitment that it takes to stay certified, you know, folks have to be out there working. They don't have the time to go out and answer calls. New York State is the 48th of 51 states and territories for volunteerism. So that's from the Corporation for National and Government Services in 2016. And this has caused a significant burden to some of our service and reliability issues with other services. So some of the other system issues that play a role in this, in getting an ambulance to your family member or yourself if they're having a life-threatening emergency, include the fact that municipalities are required, as you well know, to provide police protection and fire protection, but not emergency medical services. Many fire departments no longer offer EMS services, and those that do cannot deliver these services effectively with a limited number of volunteers and with limited funding. The number of EMS calls far outweighs the number of fire calls for municipalities, and in the handout that I gave you, gives you the 2017 numbers towards the bottom of the page of the number of EMS calls versus fire calls within St. Lawrence County. Fire departments cannot bill insurances for reimbursement. General municipal law does not allow that. If fire departments could bill, then it would cut into reimbursement for agencies who are providing advanced life support services to them based on Medicare and Medicaid rules, so it's a no-win situation. We understand that the county and the municipalities do not have the funding to provide EMS, but eventually this will fall on the backs of the municipalities and the counties when an ambulance cannot get to your constituents. They will come to you. EMS is a fragmented system at best. At the state level, there have been multiple cuts to the Department of Health's Bureau of EMS that has left training reimbursements unchanged for years, has decreased their ability to provide oversight to the agencies, and the inability for the Bureau to seek solutions to the current crisis across the nation. At the regional level, this has caused a domino effect. There's been no increase in funding for any local contractors who attempt to assist them, such as my office. My office has been funded $146,600 since 1997 with increased health care deliverables and no increase in funding. So with, you know, the cost of benefits being more and everything else, we are down to a staff of one and an assistant. And again, the last increase that regional or local entities have had for the program agencies was 1997. At the county level, many counties no longer have EMS coordinators. This leaves no one to focus on the issues of getting ambulances out the door. The emergency managers we work very closely with. Our office works closely with them as well as the other services, but they have a lot on their plate. This is one of many issues that they deal with. At the agency level, agencies are required to hold what's called a certificate of need for areas, but there's absolutely no regulation that they service that area of need to provide timely ambulance service. Ambulances are made up of multiple different business structures. Regardless of how they are set up, EMS has become a business and the regulations are onerous. Now my question for you folks is, if you owned a business, would you have a volunteer run that who works another full-time job and expect that business to be successful? So with that said, many agencies that are now business, they have to meet not-for-profit corporation laws if they're a not-for-profit, that have to meet the onerous regulations of the Department of Health, Bureau of EMS, education regulations that are placed on them, OSHA regulations that are placed on them. And if they are lucky enough to be able to have a staff member to help cover calls, which many do not, then they have to meet labor law regulations. And this is all expected to be done on the shoulders of a volunteer who has a family and is working a full-time job. The fact is, most agencies are non-compliant with all the regulations, not intentionally, but because they are so onerous, as I said, it has become a full-time job for them to be compliant. Reimbursement for commercial and not-for-profit agencies who are able to bill for their services are subpar. The reimbursements through Medicare and Medicaid do not even begin to cover the operational cost of having an ambulance staffed and available 24/7 throughout the county in multiple locations. As you know, we have a rather large county. Education for EMS, reimbursements for class do not meet the cost to provide them. As I said earlier, we have a limited number of instructors who can provide this education. SUNY Canton is the only course sponsor in the county that is certified to offer courses, and they are not certified to offer paramedic level courses because they do not have the resources or the staff to be able to do that. The nearest paramedic program is in Jefferson County through Jefferson Community College. And as you know, for many of our local residents, that is over an hour drive in this wonderful North Country weather to even begin to get the education to become a paramedic. And at this time, they are currently struggling to make ends meet. To become a paramedic, it's a two-year program where they can become certified or have an associate's degree. And it involves thousands of clinical hours as well. So for the most part, our agencies here have very few paramedics. We have 19 in this whole county, and only 10 of them are actively in the field providing care. We do have a little bit lower level of care that can provide advanced life support to folks. That's the critical care level, which the state, as of the beginning of this year, no longer recognizes, where they had to attend 9 months of education along with some extensive clinical hours to become certified. But the state is not able to continue to offer the education for that course any longer, and it has been sunset. So for those providers in the county that are currently at this critical care level, they can remain through continuing medical education requirements, but there will be no new advanced level providers in this county unless we find new avenues for paramedic education. Over the years, there have been many attempts to fix this. Our office continuously strives, along with the local, the county EMS advisory boards. Agencies have become not-for-profit to enable them to bill for services, while in some instances, again, that may cover the cost of an ambulance and supplies, but it does not cover personnel to provide the care in many cases. Management of these not-for-profits requires full-time attention, as any other business would. Recruitment and retention programs have not been sustainable, as it's difficult to sustain programs on the backs of volunteers. Training more providers has not been the answer because it does not allow them more time to volunteer, and agencies do not have funding or the ability to pay them to provide that care. Should we consider quality as opposed to quantity as we move forward? I believe the answer is yes. Fundraising has not been successful as volunteers are challenged to find a balance between covering calls and conducting fundraisers. The list goes on and on for both the challenges and the things that have been done to attempt to fix those, but I know I am running out of time. So the biggest reason that I'm here for tonight is to make you aware of this crisis within the county. Also to support the following state legislation, which is on your handouts that I handed out, that I gave you, that will allow direct insurance reimbursement. One of the challenges is patients get the money directly reimbursed to them from insurance companies, and they have a good time with that money, and it never gets paid to the EMS agency, who in many instances does not always have the ability to go at, to collect from them. So that bill is to have insurance companies directly reimburse the entity providing care versus the patients themselves. That would assist. And to make emergency medical services an essential service, which would allow more grant access in municipal funding. We ask that you support those current legislative efforts. Also to work with the Departments of Social Service to increase Medicaid reimbursements to the Medicaid and Medicare funding. As the American Ambulance Association and other associations are currently working with Medicare to change their reimbursement structures. But our biggest request is that the legislature become involved in the efforts to find a solution to this crisis by creating a task force to help address the issue within the county and to help look at additional alternatives of how emergency medical services are offered within the county and look, for different opportunities to strengthen the system. So that is a very high level overview of the crisis that's going on.
Mr. Akers.
Big challenges. I know it's a big time commitment. I think that's a big problem for getting volunteers. But you mentioned earlier that we're 48th. We rank 48th out of the 50 states and the one territory. And so certainly those other states have similar challenges. Why does New York State rank so low? Are there other onerous regulations that that other states don't have?
So that information was retrieved from the nationalservice.gov online. If you would like to find more information in regards to that locally, I can speak to the fact that the requirements to maintain your certification to be an EMT, the requirements to for the education to be an EMT, the paperwork, right? Every job has paperwork that's required after transporting every patient. The distances of transports, in some cases, there are a multitude of reasons why the volunteerism has decreased in the area.
So would those be additions in the last 15, 20 years that really have created this large decline in the availability of volunteers?
So this has been a steady decline for many years. And we are starting to see it come to a greater fruition where it's actually affecting ambulances getting out the doors.
So if you're having this lack of volunteer services and stuff, apparently the services aren't lucrative enough for private entities. We only have two commercial entities here.
Correct.
And they aren't actually answering 911 calls? One of them isn't?
One of them does answer a limited number of 911 calls. The other one does not. So the commercial services find it very difficult to make ends meet. We just recently, TransCare, which was a large ambulance service in the New York City area, just up and overnight went bankrupt. Again, lots of reasons behind that, but the biggest one is Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement does not meet the cost of operating an ambulance.
Okay. So in assembling a task force here at the local level here amongst this legislative group or a bunch of volunteers, again, that's a difficult task as far as going after or having a voice as far as increasing the funding in Medicaid and Medicare through our state senators. So,
I think
not impossible, but I'm saying, but it's a heavy lift.
Right, and I understand. I understand those challenges, but I think that it was important for me to come here tonight because I am sure that you have all seen it in the papers here or there, and as I would love to sit here and say we fixed the problem, it's only going to get worse. People are dying.
Right.
And, you know, I think that the county may need to look at different systems, and if we can put together some kind of task force where we can work through some of these challenges.
I think part of it could be like an education piece. People don't know how much time it actually requires. I'm from Madrid, you know, they're shrinking there, and you got a couple older guys, Dick and Mr. Ballard, and he's still in it because he likes to drive fast, primarily, and Greg. But, I mean, what kind of time commitment to be trained at, even at the basic level of what's being required now, are we asking these volunteers to take up?
At the basic level, we are asking these volunteers to spend 150 to 160 hours to achieve initial certification. And at this time, they have to, following their initial certification, and along on top of that, 10 hours of clinical or ambulance ride time.
Okay.
So a total of up to 170 hours classroom clinical. And then they have to do, currently it is 72 hours of continuing medical education every 3 years to maintain their certification or they need to attend a refresher course.
So that's almost like a month of somebody's time, at least in the initial year, to get trained, not even counting the clinical time. You take 150, 160 hours. It's like 30 days out of their lives. So I can see why people have to be really committed to really want to do this to get involved.
Yes. And that, and actually speaking of, you know, a couple older gentlemen that are providing EMS in that one area, most of these agencies do not have sustainability plans, and an injury to one of those or their inability to be in the back of the ambulance, which is a very physical job to provide emergency medical services, can make the difference whether they can get out the door at all.
Yeah, those two gentlemen are doing much of the major lifting in Madrid. Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Forsythe.
Do you find that there's an average age of the existing EMTs? Is it an older group? Do you find the young people coming through and wanting to be EMTs?
So most of the ones that cover calls and are reliable are of the older generation.
I think every volunteer group has the same dilemma.
Yes. You know, we do get new faces here or there, but, you know, sometimes it's hard to maintain those or to even run the agencies because, you know, you're not there all the time as a full volunteer agency.
Sure. Mr. Denisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thanks for coming here and making the presentation. You know, I'm very familiar with, I've been in the volunteer fire service for over 40 years myself, and I know how difficult it is to get volunteers. And, you know, a very large part of that is the increased training regulations. And, you know, I think a lot of this, a lot of what we're saddled with is geared toward cities. You know, people forget that this is a rural area. You know, just look at the size of St. Lawrence County. Yeah, we've got a few not-for-profits, but the bulk of the you know, is fire departments, and it's volunteers. And you know, and I've listened to Mark, and I've listened to a number of other folks that are involved with EMS, and you know, I know one of the issues is getting paid. Medicare and Medicaid reimbursements don't even come close to covering the cost. The other one, as you hit on, is, and I know I've heard this a number of times, that folks get a reimbursement check from their insurance company, but the emergency service provider never sees it. And another big thing, and I don't know if this is just anecdotal or not, but there's a great number of ambulance calls that probably don't need to be ambulance calls.
Absolutely.
They could be transported in an automobile. But because the service is there, we'll call 911, we'll get someone to, and I know a number of cases that's happened. Mm-hmm. So this thing is, you know, it's as broad as it is wide. You know, I know how critical volunteers are. I know how critical the service is. But, you know, there's a lot of abuse. There's abuse on both sides. There's abuse from the folks that are taking advantage of the service, and there's abuse from where the pay should be coming from as well. Yeah, I wish I had an answer, you know, but I think... is something that we need to keep working at. But I think one of the big things is it's tough to get volunteers because the training regulations. You know, we got people that are leaving their homes on a Sunday afternoon. People are getting up in the middle of the night. People are missing work. You know, whether it's fire department, whether it's ambulance service, and you know, this is a volunteer. And you hit on it, you know, when you mentioned about funeral directors. My dad was a funeral director. That's what his life's work was. And I can remember as a young man that he had an ambulance. That was part of being a funeral director. You know, Buster Lawrence did it. You know, every funeral director in St. Lawrence County, that was a service that they provided. But then it got to the point where the regulations and the legal community got involved, and that's when everything started to go down.
Thank you. Yeah, and another challenge is the fact that because of, you know, the legal community and, you know, you are out there caring for patients, is that many of the providers fear, you know, litigation as well. You know, they are not, you know, they're not volunteering, you know, and I'm not discrediting anything because it's an important job too. They're not volunteering to put a meal out for somebody. They are treating patients with life-threatening emergencies in many cases, and they're, you know, being asked to do that for free.
Mr. Akers.
Well, and if we were to set up a task force, many of us, I don't know if any of us are volunteers. I know Larry with his service in the fire department, and I don't know if Chad was involved. Are you involved with EMS? I guess Dan Parker used to sit in that seat, was heavily involved. There must be, rather than reinventing the wheel, there would be things that you could give to us, a sheet, things that you think that need to be done that would, you know, help alleviate the problem, or at least, you know, trend, whether it's statewide legislation, funding, or whatever, that would point the task force in the right direction.
And absolutely. Again, currently one of our neighboring counties, Essex County, not neighboring, but down the ways a little bit, Essex County has been able to pull together with their local legislators and their local government officials, and they have gotten the ear of the governor's office. This is the first year that I believe, to my knowledge, that in the state address, Governor Cuomo actually addressed rural EMS. Okay, so maybe some of those solutions are coming.
Okay.
But in the meantime, you know, we're acting for people to be, we're asking for people to be aware of this and, you know, to go out to their colleagues at their local municipalities and ask them what they know about their ambulance services. I have found, you know, in the involvement, I can guarantee that the towns and villages don't really even know what's happening within their own communities in many cases.
Well, if you could get us something, on the 16th, we're having a work session here for ideas that we want to take to the state legislative body. So that would be at 3 o'clock on the 16th. So if you could get something to Ruth before that time period about agendas that you would like for us to push on that, when we meet with our legislators down there, senators and assembly people, that we can promote those ideas.
Absolutely, and I'm actually leaving here to head to Albany to for state EMS meetings and to see what is on the legislative agenda for this session. So.
Any other comments or questions for Ian? No? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we're going to move right on to the Sheriff's Department. We have a couple of resolutions there tonight. First is an authorization to fill a correction officer position in the Sheriff's Office Correctional Division. Mr. Forsythe, Mr. LaPierre, Mr. DeNisha.
As you look at these, did they have the updated one with the new fringe in their packets? Okay. If you look at budget position number 67, I believe that should be the first one you have. You don't know for sure.
This is
The first one should show a salary of the person leaving it, I think was 51. Is that what you guys have in front of you?
42.
No.
42? Okay. That sent the updates through. Should read for, okay, that one should read 42,628. Mm-hmm. Yep, it's the second one. And then you can see that the fringe level is that's on there should come out. I think it's 22,495 for the next position. Both of these positions I'm bringing forward to you today are full-time corrections officers positions, and both of them are resignations due to people being hired by state corrections and leaving us to go to a state corrections position. The higher salary one that's on the next, the second one, is been with us for a few years, and then but the one that's in front of you right there right now, 67, is fairly new, so he's already at the base level of a corrections officer at this point. So there's not a big savings there with that change and breakage there, but there is on the next one.
any discussion on the first resolution? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That's carried. And Sheriff, I'm assuming you don't want to add anything more in the second one because you just covered them both.
Right, yeah, they're both covering this.
So on the second resolution, is there any discussion? You're right. All in favor?
Aye. Yes, speak to a couple things if you can bear with me for a minute. Jail count's been hovering right around 147 to 151, somewhere around there. The end of last week, we brought back a few females, and I expect by the end of this week to have all the females back inside the facility that nobody housed out. There'll be a few people straggling around on our books that belong, they're being housed by somebody else at somebody else's expense, but they're still on our books. But I expect to have all the females back. Our male population's fairly controlled. And there was, tomorrow, there'll be six going to Dannemora, six males. And we went to Albion this morning with a couple of females, and I expect that by next Monday we'll be going to Albion again with a few more females. The criminal justice system is moving along, which is always a good sign. We've been having a lot of interaction as an office with the district attorney's office as the transition is being made there. They've been meeting everything from meeting with the district attorney himself and his senior staff to meeting with investigators and whatever the assigned ADA is going to be for certain specialties, such as the drug task force. They've been meeting and getting everybody up to speed on the case files and concerns over time limits and different things like that. So far, so good with that interaction. I believe there was a question within your group about the fact that we assisted in participating with a couple other law enforcement agencies before Christmas in delivering some presents one day. That's something we've done for the last couple of years. I want to say somewhere like 40 gifts or 40 households in 60-some gifts, I think, into 40 households. We had also participated in a couple of assisting a few other, you know, families in regards to just checking in on people, checking in on some seniors, things like that, over the holidays and over these cold breaks. And but even back to Halloween, we were assisting the event in Messina, where the phenomenal amount, I think 1,000 kids or something like that, that came through that event in Messina, where we had our canine patrol up there assisting. So with several of them, like 6-7 different law enforcement agencies participated in that. So we're out there. You know, we have a lot of people that work for us that volunteer their own time. And in regards to many types of organizations and church work, different things like that. So, you know, they're a good group that work for us, and we appreciate it very much. Any questions of me?
Mr. Lightfoot.
Thanks for offering. Have you been involved in any conversations with the Magistrates Association regarding a centralized location for arraigning prisoners in light of the requirement for an attorney at their first arraignment?
Right. I think what you're talking about is there's those pilot counties out there?
No, I'm talking about the St. Lawrence County Magistrates Association.
The only thing I have attended, along with I think the probation director and my undersheriff, a few other people, there was a meeting that was held at the club back before Christmas, back whatever, I think their December quarterly meeting for the Magistrates Association, where they brought up one of the gentlemen, judges from, I want to say Washington County, but it might have been one of the other ones right along the Northway right there. But he's somebody that had been the judge for the magistrates. He'd been the supervising judge for the magistrates, why Judge Richards wasn't available to do that.
Hobbs,
that's the name. And we listened to a presentation by him, but it was brief. And I know that the discussion is out there. I've been having discussions with Washington's county sheriff, because they have implemented it and talked about some of the issues and, you know, in implementation that they've gone through. They got up really quick with that whole thing. Warren County's been trying to do some things, but they've been like 2 years trying to get something done. One of the things that would have to be possible would be a piece of legislation through the state legislature that would allow me to be able to utilize our county correctional facility as a holding cell. I don't have that legal right now to put anybody in there that hasn't been put in there by a judge's order. That is something that we have never asked for, just because of the logistics of the county and several other reasons and concerns about manpower and being able to have the resources to do it. I know that's a discussion that's required as part of it. There was also discussion among those groups of magistrates and everybody else about what do we do about having an arraignment court. Is there a place in the lobby of the jail to do an arraignment court? Where would you have that arraignment court? My question is, who's going to remove these people from the secure portion of the correctional facility to come out to that arraignment court? Where's that manpower coming from? And who's going to transport them? Is that PD that originally arrested them, or that trooper that originally arrested them, going to come back to the jail and pick that person up that we held on to, that they normally would have held on to? And are they going to take those people and take them for arraignment, or am I going to have personnel to be able to move them from point A to point B? There's so many questions that come out, and it really comes down to the logistics of it. Where's that court going to be? Where's that judge going to sit? If you remember, for anybody that was here back when we were building a correctional facility, or talked to people, one of the things we proposed was actually having a courtroom within our facility when we built it. And the county court level judges wanted nothing to do with having a court set up over to the jail set and off of this campus. They want nothing to do with that. And now we're talking about maybe rotating town justices through and some type of wheel where it's your turn up to go. And that's kind of how it's working in Washington County. But Washington County, you know, it's a big, long county, but it's nowhere near the square miles that we have here. So, yes, your answer, long-winded question, is yes. I've been involved in the discussions. But there is nothing out there that's a mandate towards us now, just the discussions and to try to set up the plan.
Well, if I may,
go ahead.
Is there anything that you can agree to with respect to what you just talked about?
Well, I'd be willing to have a discussion about making our facility and starting the state legislative process to at least have that piece taken care of. But other than that, I need somebody to tell me what their plan is before I can tell you what we're capable of doing. But I have nothing that we've ever said no to in any way. Just it's so preliminary that nobody has the answers to the questions that we ask.
How was the problem of having a holding cell or a holding area addressed legislatively by the counties that obviously have that authorization by law now?
Even before this discussion of judges, there's some counties that did that, just as a relief for some of the local PDs to have a place to put their people because they couldn't get any judges to come out, because that's one of the big issues is that's developed over many years, is you can't find judges that are willing to come out after hours sometimes to arraign. Sometimes we make 5, 6, 7 phone calls before we find a judge, and then you end up abusing the same judge over and over again. And there's getting to be less and less of those people that are willing to be that person. And they're retiring on us. And, so it's an issue that's out there, you know, and many counties have done it for many different reasons. We've never had the issue because there's still the bigger PDs, Ogdensburg, Messina, they still have holding cells,
right.
And which are all under the purview of the Commission of Corrections. There's a lot of rules that go into having holding cells compared to what they used to be years ago. So we have the space, but that also means a concentration and an extra liability that comes onto the county to utilize that space that we have in the correctional facility already. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we have to take into consideration, because when you get somebody that's in a holding capacity, chances are they're either drunk or high, and there's all sorts of new rules in regards to the Commission of Corrections and anybody that comes into your jail under opiate possible usage. If they screen out a certain way, we have to transport them to a hospital. And now here I have this person sitting in my holding cell that's not really my prisoner, because no jails could judges put him in our jail. And now whose responsibility is it to take them back to the hospital and sit and watch them? So these are just things that run through our heads as we're looking at these.
That's the reason I asked you, okay. Is because I would like to know if, for instance, the Magistrates Association is deciding upon some procedure that is going to affect you to a great degree. Mm-hmm. You need to know what the costs of that are going to be, and the manpower needs, and the legal authority to do what they may want to do. Mm-hmm. What I would like to see from you, if you could, and I'm not asking you to do it by tomorrow, maybe the next day, but not tomorrow, is what would it take manpower-wise, space-wise, to afford the criminal justice system in St. Lawrence County that space in your facility, number one. Number two, to staff it, it's got to be a secure area. Mm-hmm. So it's like you say, the likelihood of additional manpower or using the manpower that you have is going to enter into the picture. I'm looking at, what do we need for manpower if we need manpower? What is this going to cost us? What are the things that we're not looking at? How many people could you hold in this holding cell, holding area before you've got a problem? I would like to have those answers in hand before we get a plan from the magistrates.
And again, those are same discussions the sheriffs have been having across the state with their regards to the municipalities within their counties. And so it's an ongoing discussion, and it's also something that you only have, I think there's five of those pilot counties right now, and we're not one of those. So, but we are paying attention to it, we are listening to it, and I can get you some information because we've been looking at it.
Any other questions for the sheriff? Seeing none, thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you. Good night.
He's not here, so Jason's
here. We're going to move along to a presentation from the Planning Department on the State Septic System Replacement Program. We did. What happens, Joel surprised me with the, before I read it, he surprised me with the motion, and Kevin seconded it, and we did vote on it. So we have this presentation. Jason Fotenhauer is going to do it, and this is on the State Septic System Replacement Program.
Thank you. I'm here on Keith's behalf tonight. He is home ill, unfortunately, and he's been the primary point of contact for this project, so I will try to do it justice. So what this is an initiative of the Clean Water Infrastructure, or the I guess Environmental Facilities Corp and the DEC. Those are the two state agencies that have come together and have allocated quite a bit of money, about $75 million, through the Clean Water Infrastructure Act of 2017. And it's a five-year rollout program, so about $15 million a year, has been allocated to various counties around the state to repair and replace septic systems. These are septic systems that are primarily residential in nature and for small businesses, so it's not large systems. I think it's a maximum outflow of 1,000 gallons a day of effluent, so they're mostly residential systems. Out of that $15 million that's been allocated for 2018, St. Lawrence County has been earmarked for $225,000. So that's great. Sounds excellent. You know, $225,000 for the first year to repair some septic systems that are deficient. It's unique in a number of different ways. The first way it's unique is that it is not driven by income. So it doesn't matter how much money you make. It depends where you are. It's completely geographically focused. So the intent is to improve water quality in parts of the state where the state has determined that there are water quality issues. So there are a number of areas in St. Lawrence County that have been identified. The Black Lake watershed, or specifically Black Lake. The entire length of the St. Lawrence River in the county, the Little River and its tributaries, which is somewhat unique. The Little River is an offshoot of the Grass River south of Canton here. The Indian River, which does not have a lot of water frontage in St. Lawrence County, and the lower portion of the Racket River. And I'm still trying to determine how they designate the lower portion of the Racket River, presumably in the Adirondack Park and then through Colton is what I'm guessing, but I've been trying to get a clarification on what they identify as the lower portion of the Racket. How it works is the grant will provide up to 50% of the repair replacement cost to a total of $10,000. So if your system is $15,000, you can get $7,500 back from the state. If it's a $20,000 replacement or repair, you can get up to $10,000 for that. The funds will come to the county, so the arrangement is with the county through EFC and the DEC with the county, and the county is responsible for setting up the administration and dispersing the cash to the homeowners or the small businesses, and dealing with the contractors and everyone else is doing the actual repair work. So that's the good side of it. The bad side of it, the problem that we have foreseen, is that there is no reimbursement for administration costs for this program. So what that means is that we can get up to $225,000. However, any preliminary work that would need to be done, of which there's quite a bit, there is a requirement that we send out a piece of mail basically marketing this program. There are other marketing requirements as well. So we have to let people know that this is out there through public notice as well as through direct mail. The issue with the direct mail is, looking at our geography and the size of our county, and we just did some quick GIS analysis, we're looking at about 2,000 possible properties. So that's a mailing of 2,000 pieces of mail. One expense, not a huge expense, but there is an expense associated with that. The county would also be responsible for determining the eligibility of the applicant. So again, it's not income driven, we wouldn't have to verify incomes, but it is limited to residential and primary residential. Can't be a seasonal home, can't be a second home. So that requires some legwork to determine that. We also have to determine what the actual failure of the existing system is. So there isn't, unfortunately, the county does not have the staff expertise to do that, so that means contracting with someone, an engineer, or someone else who has the ability to go and assess a septic system, determine that it is deficient, determine that it meets the various qualifications to be eligible for repair, and again, an expense associated with that. And then also monitor the work as it goes forward. Work with the contractor, ensure that it's all installed correctly. And then finally, do all the paperwork to get the money from the state. And then that can be either passed directly to the individual homeowner or business owner, or to the contractor who does the work. There is some latitude there to do that. So it's a little it's certainly I don't want to be critical of the program. I think it's an excellent program. I think it's a wonderful opportunity. It doesn't. Looking at the distribution of the monies to various counties around the state, we were one of the. There are two very large awards, and then a number of smaller awards, and our $225,000 award was received by a number of other counties as well. But we don't have the capacity in-house to move this project forward. We certainly could do the administration side of it, but actual assessment is something that would need to be contracted out. So we have had some conversations with organization that the county does some work with, the North Country Housing Council. They have administered a septic program in the past. They gave us a ballpark figure of about $2,000 a unit for all the administration. That's the existing engineering, determining what the problem is, all that, and it's sort of it's a ballpark, but it's something to use as an estimate of what it would cost to roll out this program per replacement unit. So if you look at the numbers, just again, at 10,000 a unit, $225,000, we would be able to repair about 20 or replace about 23 units. That's an administration cost of about $40,000 to $50,000 that is not covered by the grant itself. We have reached out, and Keith has written a letter to all the elected officials, state elected officials in the county, bringing this to their attention and encouraging, suggesting, recommending that, boy, this is a great program, but how is any rural county going to actually make it work because of the administration costs associated with it? So what would be ideal is if, like many other grants, that there could be a portion of the funds allotted for administration rollout of the program. And that was submitted back or sent out back on December 20th of 2017, and to my knowledge, we have not heard back from any of the officials as of yet. So I guess that's sort of a background. I don't know, Ruth, if there's anything else you wanted me to touch on, or just to open it up for questions to see if there's any thoughts.
So we're going to send out about 2,000 letters to folks, and 22 to 23 people could potentially be successful.
Right.
And not to get ahead of it, but let's say that you were just out of the criteria or just out of the award zone for this year, and then next year we get another $225,000. Would an applicant have to go through the entire process, or would
there certainly how these grants work is if you can create a database of potential clients, that's helpful because then you don't have to do as much legwork.
Right.
So yeah, I would say that if an applicant submitted this year, was not awarded or not chosen this year to be a participant, if they met all the criteria, again, if there was an occupied residence, not a second home, they were in the geographical area that was required, then yeah, they'd be on a waiting list for future funding. And again, presumably that the funding is just solid for 5 years, there's always a possibility that could change.
Mr. Burke?
It would seem like the local code enforcement officers for each of those areas should play some role in this.
Mm-hmm. They certainly would. There would be a requirement for a building permit for the installation of these septic tanks. So they could play a role, certainly. or they would be required to play a role in terms of issuing those permits. But in terms of using that, are you suggesting perhaps using them as a source to determine the deficiencies?
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking. You're certainly right on the permit, but I was thinking who in those areas would be, you know, at least initial permitting was done by code enforcement.
Right.
You know, and they probably have their ear closer to the ground than anybody at a county level would have.
Right.
You know, and I'm not sure that I'm suggesting anything, but it would seem like
right.
that it's worth exploring what role they could possibly play.
Sure. That's a good suggestion. Thank you.
Mr. Forsythe?
Yeah, you're looking at the higher end of those costs associated with a septic system, you know. Average septic system is $4,000 to $6,000.
Right.
So potentially
could do a lot more.
There could be 100 plus. Right?
Yeah.
At right. 2,000.
That's right. You
bucks a pot.
Hopefully there would be some cost equalization there. Where if it was, you know, if you're looking at a $10,000 or a $20,000 system, that's a heavily engineered system, so there's going to be more cost associated with that, versus a $4,000 system where, you know, you're digging up the steel tank, putting in concrete tank, putting in new leach field, something like that. So yeah, there could be some savings on the admin side of the smaller systems, but there maybe not. There is still a lot of paperwork involved with each system. So the more you do, the more paperwork that it generates. You know, there's a level the more you do it, the better at it you get. So it is more efficient, but there is still some unknowns there in terms of how it would actually roll out.
But it's in this agenda. It's the county's responsibility to do the mailing.
Correct.
We're mandated to
yes.
do the mailing.
Yes. If we, how one piece of information I did leave out is that's somewhat relevant is the time sensitivity of this. There is a requirement that we say whether or not we're in or out by the end of the month. So by January 31st, we need to notify the county's intent to participate. That's why we're trying to, you know, get everything figured out as quickly as we can, but
it would be a logistical nightmare.
It could
first to identify yeah. seasonal and secondary residents are excluded.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, you're talking along bodies of water, which 90%
right.
are probably seasonal or secondary.
Right.
So now you limit it down to 10. Now you got to identify that 10%. Wow. I think it's a great idea, you know, if you got to pump it uphill, it's going to cost someone $20,000.
Right.
But I think it should be an online process. They do it through the state. They go to their building inspector. They get the engineer to do the draw up and be done. I don't see why the county should have to absorb that. That'd be
right.
tremendous, I think. You know?
It could be, yeah. And that's why we wanted to get it to you for input.
Tell them to do it online. I suggest them do it online.
So, who determined the geographical area?
It was determined by the state, by the DEC and the Environmentalist Facilities Corp. There was, I guess, and I wasn't aware of this, apparently in September, there was some information that was distributed looking for input on geographies that would that are susceptible to problems. But the state determined what was given to us. And Black Lake, we all are aware that Black Lake is an issue, and certainly that's something that that we would want to address. The St. Lawrence River, that's it's a lot of water on the St. Lawrence River. You know, it would obviously exclude the city of Ogdensburg because of their municipal system. The various villages along the river that have systems, but that's a lot of 70, 80 miles of land,
right.
of waterfront.
Speaking of Black Lake, we did some projects there. Was that through the county?
That was a program that was a septic replacement program that the Housing Council, the St. Lawrence County Housing Council, yes, and it, believe it was a county, yeah, it was a county app that was administered by the Housing Council.
And those were all raised beds?
They were all individually engineered. Okay. So some were raised beds, some were all dependent on the soils and the property. Yeah.
Does the Housing Council have existing staff that would be experts or in design?
They could, and we did have a conversation with them about it, and we said, well, you know, would you like to do this? There's no admin money, and they said, you know, we can't afford to do it without any admin money.
Who do they consist of, the Housing Council?
The Housing Council, they're a staff of six or seven individuals, an executive director, and then they have a housing rehabilitation specialist, a housing repair specialist.
And are they federal or state funding?
They're a local not-for-profit, so they get state monies and then grant administration monies is kind of how they're funded.
Well, I think like Mr. Forsyth says, you got 2,000 potentials and probably 90% or a good 75 at least would be seasonal or second homes. So you're down to a certain number. At the same time, it makes sense to say that we're in. And I don't see why. I do think the $2,000 per site is excessive, but mm-hmm. at the same time, we could almost wash our hands of it and say we subcontract this over to the Housing Council and say, here, you take care of these are the monies, take care of it. Is that possible or not?
I think that they would not accept it unless there was some administration monies, because they would be doing it for free then.
Right.
And then you know, that's a lot of work that they would have to undertake, and that would take them away from projects that earn them some money to keep the doors open.
Right.
Basically.
So those funds would have to come from the county.
Presumably, yeah. That would. That's, I guess, the essence is that if we were to sign on here, it's with the understanding that there will be a county cost associated with implementing this program.
Well, that makes it very difficult. Okay. Thank you,
Mr. Denisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think if the San Luis County Housing Council, they're unwilling to do it for free, I really can't understand why St. Lawrence County would be willing to do it for free. And the other thing that troubles me is it's not income based. So if you've got somebody that's got a $500,000 primary residence on St. Lawrence River, there's no way in the world that I would support giving them money so that they could improve their septic system. Now, when you've got somebody that's over in the middle of Pirates, maybe that needs a septic system because they've got people call for them and they're dug well, and they can't get an improved septic system, but we can give it.
Any other comments or questions for Jason?
So we'll have to make a decision here. So, Ruth, what would be the proper procedure here?
Our interest was in getting the information out to you, and then we can revisit it at Finance on the 22nd. Okay. And perhaps have some conversations in your local communities, and then identify if we'd like to opt in is what we would need to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Arquette.
Sure. How we came up with that 2,000 number is, I think it doesn't include the seasonals. What we did was we used the real property data records, which are pretty accurate. They're not certainly 100% accurate. That's why the verification would be required. But they're classified. Every parcel has a certain classification on it, and all residential properties are classified in the 200 category. So. We selected all the 210s, which are the residences. 210s through 240s are residences. 270s are manufactured homes. And 260s are seasonal homes. So we excluded the 260s and just picked the others. So that's how we came up with that 2,000 number. So that's closer. I think it's closer to 2,000 than 100 for all the we're just looking at so much geography. It's just, there's so much land. It's their requirement. It is. We could. Yeah, we could break it up by district.
Mr. Forsythe.
If you put an ad in the paper, no, really, if you put an ad in the paper saying that there's $225,000 available for San Lawrence River area, this, with the guidelines, see your local town assessor, you'll have that list filled in no time. You won't have to go looking for people to sign up. They'll be on that. Like, I don't know why we'd have to mail something to every household.
I agree. Unfortunately, you know, that's the regs.
The word will spread.
Yeah.
So.
Anyone else? Okay. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
And we are going to, since we're going into Services Committee after this, we're going to hold the County Administrator's Report, the old and new business, and the executive session till that next meeting. So if there's any other business to come before this committee, and I see none, so we'll declare this committee meeting adjourned.
We had a couple long presentations.
We did. Yeah, we got feedback. It was something wicked, the feedback. We're going to see if I noticed when it came in.
I'd like to call the Services Committee meeting for Monday, January 8th, 2018 to order and ask for a motion to approve the agenda. Mr. LaPierre, Mr. Timmerman, first and second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Need a motion to approve the minutes from December 11th. Mr. Timmerman, second. Mr. Denisha. All in favor, or is there any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? That carries. We're up to our resolutions. The first one is modifying the 2017 budget for social services, reducing revenue for the child care block grant. A motion. Mr. Burke, second. Mr. Perkins. Chris?
Yes, this proposed resolution addresses an imbalance that was created during the budget process. It is within the department and is using prior year refunds to fund the increase in revenue. It's related to expenditures in the child care block grant being higher than budgeted.
Is there any discussion? Questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one is a motion modifying the 2017 budget for social services for adoption and the in-home parenting program. Mr. Paquin and Mr. Perkins. Questions?
There's another budget modification request. This one is due to an increase in the number of adoptions in 2017 and also a late billing. This also is within the department budget.
Any questions? Discussion? Yes, Mr. Akers.
I just think that that's wonderful news that you get people that are willing to adopt children and in this economy and environment.
Absolutely.
Great news.
Absolutely true.
Anybody else? Do you know how many adoptions you had during 2017?
Yes, I believe 35, and there had been in 2016, 15.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, I need a motion modifying the 2017 budget for social services due to a reclassification for juvenile delinquents, persons in need of supervision. Motion, Mr. Perkins, second. Mr. Burke.
So this proposed resolution has to do with the reclassifications of children by the court to status requiring the juvenile delinquent or persons in need of assistance categories. It may seem that this is related to raise the age legislation, possibly for 2018. It's not. This is really the expenses for juvenile delinquents and persons in need of supervision and residential placements connected with those, and the classifications for those being a little bit different than anticipated initially. This is an area where we've had some good news. The 2016 actual expense is actually about $100,000 higher than we're estimating for 2017. So there's been a decrease there, although we are over budget here. They're not the same size of budget modifications that we had. I believe in 2016 we had almost $200,000 worth of budget modifications in this category.
Any questions or discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, I need a motion for authorization to fill a clerk position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Hooper, second. Mr. Brick.
This proposed resolution is for a position that is vacant due to a promotion. It is a very efficient way for us to avoid sanctions and help make sure that we're prepared for trial and taking care of the work in the legal office. It's really essential to make sure that children are safe and that we're minimizing the potential expenses for the county relating to foster care or other challenges. This is also a position with a high reimbursement, approximately 81%.
Any discussion? Questions? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. And the last one for Social Services, I need a motion for authorization to fill a principal account clerk position in the Department of Social Services. Mr. Arquette and Mr. Pinkman.
This also is a proposed resolution relating to a position that is vacated due to a promotion and is in the accounting unit. It's a key position for our claiming of reimbursement and other essential accounting activities. And just like the previous position, is highly reimbursed at about 81%, and we're the value that we get from this position is enormous. They are exceedingly involved in all of the work that the county is doing in the Social Services Department to make sure that we're doing what we need to make sure that reimbursements are correct.
Any discussion or questions for Chris? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Youth Bureau, we need a motion authorizing the chair to sign a contract with the Office of Children and Family Services for Sexually Exploited Youth Safe Harbor Program and modifying the 2018 budget in the Office of the Youth Bureau. Motion, Mr. Paquin and Mr. Lightfoot. Go ahead, Joy.
Okay. This resolution is to accept $30,000 from the Office of Children and Family Services to increase education and awareness about human trafficking and sexually exploited youth in St. Lawrence County.
Any questions? Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Joanne.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Community Services, we need a motion for authorization to fill a medical consultant position in the Community Services Department. Mr. Hooper, second by Mr. Burke.
I can speak to the medical consultant position. We have not in the past designated in recent years a medical director, which is the role that this medical consultant, which is a title we use for civil service, will utilize. It's currently a position that we have on staff that's currently providing one day's hours worth of work for us. We'll pick up this role as medical consultant, medical director, which will probably provide another half day's work worth of hours, as well as in the event that there's an overflow with any patients associated with Suboxone or Vivitrol, he would be able to help out with that as well. So this is a rate that we probably wouldn't get with any other individual. It really is getting the most for our dollar.
Any questions or discussion? Yes, Mr. Lightfoot.
Is this covered by a contract?
This has been this year for the one day's work. This actually will move into an employment environment.
Thank you.
Anybody else? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a registered professional nurse position in the community services department. Mr. Burke and Mr. Perkins.
This position is as a result of a position that you've just created at the organizational meeting. We have separated the title. We now have a registered nurse that also will be providing the quality assurance function for us. And as a result of filling that position, this registered professional nurse position in community services will become vacant. We'd like to fill this, and the reason we're going to be changing the function of this position just a little bit. In chemical dependency, we had been providing medical assessments. We have not been doing that in mental health, and that is a billable service, as well as in the event when we have been doing it, it's been by the higher level medical professional, and arguably could be done by either an RPN or an LPN. And accomplished so that frees up that higher level medical professional to bill for services that they're required to provide. So this, the estimation given in vacancy was approximately, depending on using numbers from last year, we would approximately be able to estimate a couple $100,000 worth of revenue associated with just this nurse position. That doesn't take into account the additional time for the higher level psychiatrist or the PA in the time that they would be freed up from to provide additional service. So for us, this was definitely a position that we were ready to recommend to be filled.
Any questions? Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next one, we need a motion for authorization to fill a fiscal officer position in community services. Mr. Hooper, seconded by Ms. Bell.
This position will become vacant within probably about 4 weeks' time. So you've approved the office manager position, which recently became vacant. The interest is in having that position filled because these are essentially the two senior level positions in the clerical area of community services. So they handle all the infrastructure and support functions associated with the clinics, both mental health and chemical dependency. This fiscal officer position, though, we have a couple of years ago, you'll recall, we separated that function just a little bit. And in the way that this position provides the function for the provider pass-through dollars. So this individual deals with the providers in the county that receive funding through both Office of Mental Health and OASIS, Office of Alcohol and Substance Abuse. So they help make sure that all that funding goes out to those agencies and all of the paperwork and filing that needs to be sent along to the state is handled. They provide the updates to the Community Services Board, as well as they assist in the billing function for the clinics. But by and large, this position is to deal with the providers in the county.
Mr. Forsyth.
Ruth, on these last couple of positions, how are we sitting here supposed to be able to evaluate it? By the revenue stream that we're going to see?
For the fiscal officer position, that's difficult because that position is a financial position in the department. For the RN, we can provide you with the revenue associated with the billing once that position is
done. And we should see a trend from last year?
Yes, that's different from the trend going forward because we're going to be providing additional service.
Okay.
And we could do that as a part with community services, as a part of the quarterly report so that you can start to measure in smaller increments. That probably would be helpful once that
position is done. So we just have an idea. Sure, it looks good and sounds good, but how do we know what it is?
Agreed. I think we've had that conversation a lot of times with the budget in general. When you have revenue-generating positions, how are you sure? And how do those dollars get tied to the position? We can do that with the medical consultant as well as the fiscal officer, or not fiscal officer, the RN, if you'd like.
Okay. Anybody else? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Last one.
Last one for community services. We need a motion for authorization to abolish a mental health counselor position and create and fill a licensed social worker position in community services. Mr. Burke, second by Ms. Bell.
This position actually is a change in title, but no change in function. So late last year, you'll remember that OMH provided the county with fundings for a family support team, for a case manager, and for, at the time, a licensed mental health counselor. We were attempting to work within the confines of the titles established in St. Lawrence County Civil Service, along with meeting the criteria associated with this grant. So the grant provides all the funding for salary and most of the funding for the fringe. In this situation, we have an LCSWR able to come and work for us. And in this situation, that is the belief of the department head, is the most credentialed individual we could have on this team. Again, no county cost for the salary. What we're requesting be done here is that we change out the title from licensed mental health counselor to social worker. And if you go back a couple years in time, you'll remember when we had quite a difficult time with both of these titles, with people in positions in the inverse. We had to correct social workers with counselors sitting in them, and vice versa. So what we'd like to do is, when we see this coming, go ahead and bring this back in front of you so that you can make that change before there's a person sitting in the position. That helps us deal with all the credentials associated with any exam or any T&E that's associated with their credentials.
Questions or discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. And we have one resolution for Office for the Aging. We need a motion for authorization to abolish a senior program coordinator position and create and fill a program coordinator position in the Office for the Aging. Mr. Arquette and Mr. Denisha, Ms. Bell, second.
Hello. So what we're doing with this is, once we had the senior program coordinator position, the state changed the rules a bit of how we could utilize the position. It didn't really flush out the way that we had intended due to some restrictions with funding. The person could only operate within the New York Connects balancing incentive program. So what we've decided to do after we had a resignation was to downgrade the position and make it a program coordinator. This will allow us to stay within the constrictions of the funding stream, have that person work within New York Connects. It's also going to provide us an opportunity for some cross-training in two of our other programs that require program coordinator level staff members to complete those types of case management roles. That's our in-home care program as well as our Medicare insurance counseling. Currently, we have two staff members in those roles and no cross-training. So this will allow us to have more cross-training and as well as to serve more clients.
Any questions or discussion for Andrew? Yes, Mr. Akers.
So it doesn't say about immediately filling or 60 days or anything, so.
It does. I think that might have gotten removed. At the time, we requested that it be immediately filled, as we're using the balancing incentive funds totally for the position, and there's no county cost. Okay.
So it will be recommended immediately?
Yes.
Okay.
We can update the language to add immediately fill.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. County Administrator's report.
Okay. Wanted just to give you, you looked at a few positions, both from the sheriff and on this agenda. I just wanted to give you a brief update of the entire picture of the vacancy meeting that took place on January 4th. We looked at a total of 8 departments with 13 positions. As Andrea just spoke to, there was an additional position that the Vacancy Review Committee held. In the instance where it was a net zero, so a downgrade, that position was recommended. We're going to work with her and with her fiscal person to take a look at the other position and bring that back to vacancy. But other than that, you will see on your finance agenda 3 other departments with requests to fill, and we had a put forward recommending 12 and holding the one I just spoke to. So that was the vacancy committee meeting Last week, I attended the State of the State in Albany. It was the first time that I had attended that event, and certainly did hear about the shared services being made permanent, among many, many other things that we'll certainly tackle in the legislative agenda meeting. But I think that it's a very aggressive year in terms of what the impact may be on the counties, and we'll want to have that dialogue open and continued with the board. We will have and have scheduled a follow-up conference call with our neighboring counties on the Juvenile Detention Center for Thursday, January 11th at 3. And as the state indicated to us, corralling the interest of the northern counties is very important at this point as they continue to put together the numbers for what it would look like, at least in this facility. So we have, I believe, three counties confirmed already and looking to both confirm their interest as well as invite that they join the tour, which has been confirmed for Tuesday, January 23rd. So we'll be coordinating travel for that. If you have interest, please let Kelly know. Certainly the group that was designated by the chairman at our organizational meeting would be hoped to be able to go. But any other interested legislators, please let us know, and we'll make sure we coordinate that and get the necessary paperwork in order. We will be holding our second round of negotiations tomorrow with corrections and Wednesday with the sheriffs. That's both with their supervisor units and with their core units tomorrow and on Wednesday this week. It is our hope that we move forward and can bring back some good news to you at our next meeting. Thursday, court staff from Saratoga, and I'll brief you on some information in executive session, but the court staff from Saratoga will be here, and we will be meeting. They'll be meeting with the judges, but then they'll also be meeting with the county to have discussions about infrastructure in the courthouse building. So they'll be here Thursday afternoon. I would like to request an audit committee meeting to be held just before our finance committee on the 22nd, perhaps at 4 o'clock. I would like our main agenda discussion to include reserves. During the budget process, I indicated to the board that I would be interested in making recommendation that at the end of 2017 that reserves be created. Renee and I have been talking. We met again today to identify a couple, possibly three areas that the board may be interested in. So we'd like to bring that forward to the finance committee. And if so, establish those reserves now, and then as we get closer with our audit function complete, be able to recommend the dollar amount that would be attached to those reserves from 2017. And then, as you all know, the capital reserve currently sits in contingency. We would be looking at one of those areas also out of the 18 budget to set those funds aside. Now, it doesn't change the manner in which funds would be appropriated. They still would need board action, as they do now with contingency. So we don't make the process any more bureaucratic. What I think is we'd be setting aside and creating those reserves as an additional way to indicate financial stability. So if we could plan on that, 4 o'clock on the 22nd, that would help our finance discussion as well. The Canton Human Services Initiative Board of Directors will be meeting again on Thursday, January 25th. And then I just wanted to let you know that the fourth quarter financial update, which will by no means be gospel as to 2017's year end, I'll provide that to you at finance. As you know, our audit is still months away, but that will give you a good handle on at least operational expenses and then any areas of concern we can bring to your attention at finance as well. Any questions?
Executive session.
Categories.
All categories. So we need a motion to go into executive session. Oh, sorry. Old new business. Sorry, I forgot about that. Any old or new business? Yes, Mr. Forsyth.
My question's for Renee. Do we have any updated numbers from the tax auction? Okay.
Anything else for old or new business? All right, now we'll take a motion to go into executive session. Ms. Bell and Mr. Perkins, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. We are now in executive session.
Okay.